We are now going to hear part of a very moving speech by Ayaan Hirsi Ali, author of Infidel and Nomad, who left the Muslim religion, who has such a brave story. And this is a speech that she gave in accepting the Freedom From Religion Foundation's Emperor Has No Clothes Award in 2010.
But I'm really, really honored, really privileged to be here to get this award and to say that a little girl who was born in Somalia, standing before you, speaking to you in the English language, found my way through the darkness of what it means to grow up in a religion, in a tribal context, and in all kinds of superstitions, to be somehow rescued from all that puts me in a position that I continuously have to pinch myself. And it gives me confidence. It gives me hope in the fact that human reason, even when it's most unlikely, human reason is going to prevail over all those superstitions. And I think that this audience is familiar with superstition. You're familiar with religions in general and monotheistic religions in particular. The difference between monotheistic and polytheistic religions is monotheistic religions have gods that are extremely jealous and just they can't stand other gods, which by definition makes them unpluralistic. My mother lives in fear and terror. Every time I speak to her on the phone, she says to me, "But are you not afraid that you're going to be burned?" And I tell her, "But Mom, when I die, I'm going to rot." And I got the quote from Bertrand Russell. When you read his essay on why I'm not a Christian, he wrote it a long time ago, and you think, oh, that's all past us. And then you say those words, "When I die, I'm going to rot." And before you know, anybody who's my mother, anybody I speak to, they just go off. They go shrieking and squealing and screaming. And you think, what do you think is going to happen? I just love the name of this award. The Emperor's New Clothes. So obviously what I did was go and read the fairy tale. Hans Christian Andersen, a Danish man. Now think of the Danish cartoons. They have something there in the water, don't they? Talk of superstition. The quote, "The swindlers are trying the new clothes on the emperor. And they say, 'Does it please your majesty now to graciously undress that we may assist your majesty in putting on the new suit before the large looking glass?' The emperor undressed. And the swindlers pretended to put the new suit upon him, one piece after another. And the emperor looked at himself in the glass from every side. 'How well they look, how well they fit,' said all. Not only him, but everybody who's looking on. 'What beautiful garments, what fine colors. That is a magnificent suit. What does it say to you about the majesty and the looking glass? And the swindlers, I mean, you can blame the swindlers all you like, but the emperor wanted to be swindled. The group wanted to be swindled. Now, what I want to say is being human is to want to be swindled. You want to believe in this nonsense. You want to believe that you are not unpardonably stupid. You want to believe that you're fit for office. These are the two arguments. these are the two arguments that the emperors, the swindlers, used on when they came to this kingdom. According to Hans Andersen, they said, if you do not see the clothes that we are making, you are unpardonably stupid. Or you are unfit for office. Voila. Now, I'm human. There were times when I did make the same commitments from childhood onwards. And what was it? Who were the swindlers? Well, swindler set number one were my parents and my Quran teachers. And the first thing that I was taught about, there's Allah. Allah, God. He's just this amazing, amazing, amazing superhuman being. And if you want to understand who Allah is, just Google his 99 names or his qualities. Now, those are, I just used to recite them as a child. That's what I was taught. I was taught by my own parents and by my teachers as a child, the people I trust the most, that Allah, this figure that I hadn't seen, they didn't see him, nobody saw him, was the beneficent, the merciful, the sovereign, the Lord, the holy, the source of peace, the guardian of faith, the protector, the mighty, the compeller, the majestic, the creator, the evolver, the fashioner, the forgiver, the one who subdues, the one who bestows, the provider, the opener, the all-knowing, the judge, the all-hearing, the all-seeing. I was completely steeped in that particular form of irrationality. And after I've been told, so we have this God, he can do all these things, and he has got the greatest judgment of all, then the revelation begins, and the revelation is, Allah picks this man who can't read or write, and he sends an angel, another invisible being, to bully him in some cave, hiding from the heat, trying to get some space, and God sends this invisible creature. And he tells him, read, read. I said, read. And Muhammad says, but I can't read. The angel pulls him by the collar and demands again, read. But I can't. But you must read, read, read. The angel thunders and he clasps him, embracing him in a death grip. Great God, isn't he? What shall I read, says Muhammad, desperately. It really makes me think of Spamalot. He says, and this is the opening chapter of the Quran. Read in the name of thy Lord who created man from a clot. Read, and your Lord is the most gracious who taught with the pen. When? Taught man what he didn't know. That's how the Quran opens. Now, as a child at that point, I want to ask my teacher. At that point, it's my father. We are in Mecca. And I want to say, but father, why didn't he just make him read? Why did he need an angel? Why did he need to terrify him? But I don't ask the question. Now, between then and now, I still haven't come round to, he was made to read, but did he write? The second concept in my childhood that fascinated me, continues to fascinate me up to this time, is the concept of submission. Now, think of a God with all of these qualities. He can make you do anything, and yet he demands complete and full and utter submission from those beings that he created. Why doesn't he just create submission in you? I never played with toys, but when I came to Holland, I saw some little rich girls, and they had toy houses, and they had Barbies and whatever went with it. And these little girls were doing to the toys whatever they thought, and they said, you sit here, and you stand here, and this is the kitchen. I'm the mother, and listen. And those little girls, in some ways, if you compare what they do and say and what's in the Quran, you might end up thinking they were actually much smarter than Allah. Because now here he is creating all these beings that he can control, and everything is predetermined, and he wants complete submission. And then there are all these polytheistic Arabs, very independent-minded, very free, and they're supposed to give up their gods and go along with him. Question, why didn't he just make them go along? So there we have the revelation. Then we have the concept of submission. And it's instilled in me, just submit, don't ask questions. If you ask questions, there's Satan in you. Allah created not only good beings, but he also created Satan. You have to be careful. Asking questions means you're contaminated with Satan. So I didn't. The next thing that, when I grow up and I become a teenager and a woman, that strikes me is male sexuality and male insecurity. Muhammad, before the revelation, is married to a woman who is much older than himself. He is 25 years old when he marries her. She proposes to him. She's the daughter of this noble, powerful, honorable man who's killed in battle. And she's left with all this wealth. And he works for her as a merchant. He has the reputation of being trustworthy and great. He's faithful. He's this wonderful husband. There's another fascinating detail. As you listen to the story about Muhammad and Khadija and their, you know, their great, wonderful, happy marriage, she was 40 years old, and they have 7 children. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I'm 40 years old. I don't know if I could have 7 babies from now onwards. Let's just say they miscalculated. Maybe she was 30 and he was 15. They have 3 boys and 4 girls. The 3 boys die. All 4 girls survive. That's before the revelation. Maybe that's why he has something against girls. And that brings me, obviously, to the position of women. And I picked a verse from the Quran that I thought was going to fascinate you. It fascinates me. It fascinates me also because as I learned it, I wanted to ask all kinds of questions about it that I couldn't ask. Allah says to Muhammad, after Khadija dies, he can go now have whoever he wants. And then he has his own harem. Allah tells him, O Prophet, lo, we have made lawful unto thee thy wives, unto whom thou hast paid their dowries. So you can't just buy a woman. And those who thy right hand possesses, slaves. Of those who Allah has given thee as spoils of war, and the daughters of thine uncle on the father's side, and the daughters of thine aunt on the father's side, and the daughters of thine uncle on the mother's side, and the daughters of thine aunt on the mother's side. That's really very specific. There are all sorts of people who want to reform Islam, but they always are confronted with this kind of explicit specifics. And a believing woman, if she give herself unto the Prophet and the Prophet desire to ask her in marriage, a privilege for thee only, not for the rest of the believers. Okay, I'm in America now since 2006, and I completely understand that political leaders have privileges. You have to see this in context, right? So what Muhammad does is, I have the privilege of having an endless number of women as long as I don't sleep with my direct sister or my daughter. But you, men who follow me, you're permitted to have four wives. Then there is the temporary marriage, and that was that point about the dowry. And only the Shias took on that. If you are a male and you want to have a wife, in those days, they were too PC to use the word sex. So they would just say, have a wife. They would draw up some contract and say, just be together. You could have a relationship for 3 nights and then break off, and you were off any kind of complications. The only thing is, in those days, they didn't need condoms or any other kind of protection. So if you want to follow that, you still have to think about protection. And these are the questions that were going on in my head when I first learned about temporary marriages. I was a translator interpreter in the Netherlands. And throughout, I was called to tell people from Somalia, at least think of protection. But aside from that, think back to that Allah whose names I learned, the 99 supreme names. Why would he do that? If he was just and he was of great judgment, why would he do that? And why, if he allowed it to men, would he just not give it to women? I was confronted in the Netherlands as soon as I came into parliament by men wanting to change the Dutch constitution to lower the age of marriage from 18 to 15, because in Morocco, they were Moroccans, in Morocco, they were allowed to have child brides. And I said, no, but that's impossible in this country. And they wanted an exception because their religion allowed it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What does religion say? Well, it says we follow the example of the Prophet Muhammad. And the Prophet Muhammad married a six-year-old and consummated the marriage. That's the PC word for sex. Consummated the marriage when she was 9. Do you want to do that in Holland? If you do that, you're going to end up in jail. I'm not going to say what I said then. I'm only going to share with you an anecdote, because at some point, you will think, these are just all scriptures. It's true. The Quran was written in the 7th century. It belongs in a museum. But why is it that in the 21st century, in the United States of America, in superbly liberal countries, secular countries in Europe, women, not men, women are converting to Islam? The latest, most famous case is Lauren Booth, who is the sister-in-law of Tony Blair. She converted to Islam in a context where Sakine Ashtiani, this 40-year-old woman who was about to be stoned, she may not be stoned, she may be executed by being shot. In this context where gay men are visibly hanged, Ahmadinejad, the leader of Iran, came to Columbia University and declared, we don't have gays in Iran. We killed them all. And if he didn't kill them, then they're not going to come out and say that they're gays. And in that context, a privileged, middle-class, educated, rational human being who is female converts to Islam. How do you answer that? How do you answer that? I was confronted by women who said, in Holland, what you say about Islam being unkind to women is untrue. I was on campaign, talked to a Muslim woman, and she said, it's not in the Quran. And I picked up my Quran, I told her, well, here it is, chapter 4, verse 34. I showed it to her, and it says, men are the maintenance of women. And if you fear disobedience, warn them, leave them alone in their beds, beat them. And her whole demeanor changed from being aggressive and yelling to, oh, I can't believe this. I thought by showing her that, she would simply say, I didn't see this. Let me look into it more. I'll come back to you. Instead, she said, yeah, but it's only for bad women. For disobedient women. And I remember having a conversation like that with my half-sister, but my half-sister was more honest. She didn't deny that the verse was in there. And she said, Ayan, this verse is for women like you. Which is great, because at least I know where I stand with Muhammad. Then there's rape. The rape verses were revealed by Allah, the Omniscient, at a time when Aisha, they were on a caravan, they were wandering through the desert, and she went for a bathroom stop, and she didn't come back. And there was this whole gossip about her having a lover. Maybe she had a lover, maybe she didn't. The question never gets resolved, because a revelation drops from heaven saying that if Aisha had an adulterous stop instead of a bathroom stop, there had to be four male witnesses who actually saw the act. That's in the Quran. And that has become the testimony for rape in Islam. How many of you men here, just put up your hands. If you're going to watch an actual rape, the four of you, take place, only because you know you might be called on jury duty. That's, of course, nonsense. The testimony of a woman is worth half of that of a man. So as a woman, if you're raped, you can't produce four witnesses who can acknowledge, four male witnesses who can acknowledge that they watched you being raped, then you go to jail. And look at countries like Pakistan. 87% of women in prison in Pakistan are victims of rape because they couldn't produce four witnesses who actually saw the act. And I knew this before I left Islam. And I felt, and this is why the Emperor's New Clothes is so interesting, I didn't protest against it. I didn't dare do anything because why? Because why? Because I wanted to belong. Because I didn't want to rock the boat. Chapter 14, verse 3 says, those who love the life of this world more than the hereafter, they are astray by a long distance. That's the definition of the enemy. Who loves the life of this world more? Just put up your hand if that applies to you. So you have a problem. Like me, you have a problem. Because there is no hereafter. And declaring there is no hereafter, you're going to rot. Is asking for trouble. Another verse, Quran chapter 9, verse 111. Allah has purchased. He has purchased. Why does he need to purchase anything? He made us. Irrationality. Allah has purchased of the believers their persons and their goods, for theirs in return is the garden of paradise. So just for the sake of argument, let's believe we are not going to rot after we die. And you make it to heaven. What is it about that garden? And the Quran tells us, what you're going to get, Quran chapter 78, voluptuous women of equal age. Now, I'm looking at this audience. Okay. There's going to be another promise. Modest gaze with lovely eyes. I look across the room and I see lovely eyes, but no modest gaze. You look into those eyes and they look like rubies and coral. And you're going to be joined with them. There'll be maidens chaste, restraining their glances. And those women have not been touched by man or by jinn. Jinn is a holy, is some kind of spirit. And Allah has made them virgins. Now, do you understand why I got frustrated with the Muslim paradise? There was no promise of hunks. Nothing. There were no Brad Pitts. No George Clooney, not even Christopher Hitchens. There were no men for us. Do you know what we got promised as women? We would get grapes. And we grapes. And we would get dates. Not dates, but dates. The fruit. Now let's go back to Hans Andersen. The true hero, without any effort at all, was the child who pointed to the king and who said, this is all he said, he has nothing on at all. My father's religion makes sure that at the stage of childhood, you get to say that once but never again. It's groomed out of you, it's terrorized out of you, it's beaten out of you, it's ostracized out of you. As a child, you never get to say, but I can't see Allah, I can't. You can't. And I belong to one of those few lucky individuals in the 21st century who have said, I don't see it at all. And I thank you all for being here tonight. I thank you for giving me this award. I thank you for giving me this opportunity to say to you, I don't see it. I tried. I don't see it. And I hope that we go beyond not just pointing and saying we don't see it at all, but to, and this is a fellowship tonight here, but it's not a fellowship of believers in a super almighty God. This is a fellowship in people who recognize human reason with all its frailties. We don't claim supremacy. We are not supreme. We are not perfect. We are human. What we want for other humans is simply that recognition. And what we need to do in the 21st century, not only with Islam, but it's any kind of irrationality, be it religious, be it secular, that tries to capture human reason and make it to submit to whatever utopia of the day. That is what this fellowship is about today. And that's why I accepted this, and I'm grateful to you. You've given me that award, and I hope we can carry on. I hope this is just the beginning and that we succeed. Thank you so much.
And that is Ayaan Hirsi Ali accepting the Emperor Has No Clothes Award at the Freedom From Religion Foundation annual convention in Madison, Wisconsin.
That was in 2010.